Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. My name is John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate Connecticut author Julia Strayer. You can find Julia's fiction in Glimmer Train, Kenyon Review online, Cincinnati Review, Post Road, Smoke Long Quarterly, Mid-American Review, Indiana Review, Jellyfish Review, and others, including the Best Small Fictions Anthology. She won the Glimmer Train Short Story Award for New Writers and the 2022 New Ohio Review Fiction Contest. Today I'll be reading her story, Empty House, which was first published in the Kenyon Review. But first, let's listen to my interview with Julia, which took place on August 25th of this year. I'd like to welcome Julia Strayer to the podcast today. How are you today, Julia?
I'm great, John. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad to have you here today to talk with us about your writing and some of your stories. Now, you began writing a little bit later in life. You didn't start out as a writer. Let's approach it that way. Is that correct?
Yes and no.
Okay.
because everything isn't quite yes or no, right?
That's true.
I started out very young. My dad was an architect. And he taught me to draw. I'm not a good drawer, but what he really taught me to do was to observe the world, to look really closely at things, to see that the sun on a leaf is a different color than the leaf without sun on it. And if I'm going to draw it, I would have to shade the part that didn't have the sun on it or choose a different color from my palette. And that taught me to pay attention. And although I didn't know it that young, that's really what a writer needs to do. Any artist needs to pay attention. So I would argue that I was being groomed to be a writer or an artist of some sort from a very young age. I do have a journalism degree, my undergraduate degree, and I wrote for marketing and advertising and so forth. But you're correct in that I did not begin writing fiction until later in life.
And what was it that made that become an impulse in your life to begin to write fiction?
I always wanted to. And after I graduated from college with the journalism degree, I wanted to get an MFA. But that's a very difficult life to live as a writer. So I got an MBA instead. And I said to myself, I will go back and get the MFA later. I will write later. And then that's what I did. And I'm really, in hindsight, I'm really grateful because I was not the kind of person that had anything interesting to write about in my 20s. I needed to live and see people and learn some things. And I'm always amazed at young writers that have things to say. I envy them. I did not. So it worked out for me.
Your attention to detail, and then you were talking about your dad kind of training you to see things in a specific way. That attention to detail is apparent in your writing. There's a clear visual sense of place in your writing. You know, you create environments in an almost painterly way. Seasons seem to be also a very important part of your stories. And it seems like you've always picked for a very specific reason, a season to set the story in. Nougatine is set in the fall, and Bright and Bleached is set in the summer. And the seasons really play a big part in the story. Do you want to talk about your connection to the seasons and how that plays into the stories?
Nature in general is very important to me, and I know you're hoping for some grand mysterious answer, but the reality is I write a story in the season that it is for me when I start the story. And that means I'm working on the story maybe 6 months later and it's a whole different season, but I'm still stuck in that, whatever that season was.
That's so interesting. So it's really in that regard, a random thing based on the time that you're writing the story, but then it becomes a part of the story in a very direct way. You know, it's like sometimes the season and, you know, the weather is just kind of there as a backdrop. But for you, there's a mood that the season brings to the story. Do you feel that there's some truth to that?
Oh, absolutely. And now that I think about it, there are also instances where I might be writing a story and I don't know what season it is yet. And then I'll go back to my collected free rights. I keep a document, a Word document for each year, and I put the dates on it. So if I am just sitting somewhere with a few minutes waiting for someone to meet them for lunch or whatever, and I notice something and I write it down, it goes into this document. Sometimes I can get a whole story out and sometimes it's just one sentence, but I go back through the work and sometimes I find little gems that I can drop into a story because the mood is the same, and then it becomes that. So if I notice something in the fall, I notice how leaves are, you know, skittering across the grass, or I notice something about snow, I just write it down. And at some point, it will fit into something I'm writing.
Going back to the visual and seeing the details in the world around us, you are very attached to light, I notice, and the kind of light that's the sky is producing on a particular day.
Again, it goes back to the observing. And I think that that's one of the things that I try to teach new writers is you've got to pay attention, or you can't describe something if you don't know what it looks like. And I'm glad to hear you say that I write in a painterly way, because I think that's what you said.
Yeah.
I do write images, and I'm very aware of that. I started my fiction writing in flash fiction, so the very, very short pieces, and they're very often image focused, and that has been great. So that's important to me. I want people to be able to feel and see and hear, and almost like they're in that moment with or as that character.
You mentioned that you started by writing flash fiction. That was kind of your entry point into writing fiction.
Yes.
So maybe you can just tell us a little bit about whether that was like a conscious choice for you to start that way, thinking that that might be a good way to kind of work up to longer stories, or did that form just appeal to you right off the bat?
I took an online class through the Gotham Writers Workshop, and I had a great experience. I have nothing but great things to say about them. But when you submit your work, there's a 500 word maximum, or there was at that time. And we only needed to submit a scene or a portion of something, but I'm kind of high strung. And so I thought I should submit something that was a complete narrative. And plus, you know, the journalism in me, the marketing, advertising. Back in the day, journalism news stories were written in such a way that you got the most important information first, and you know who, what, where, when, why in the first couple of sentences. And then, because the idea was that people wouldn't read to the end of the news article. And so it was to give them everything they needed quickly. Today, that's not the way news is written. News is written so that they don't tell you anything important, so that you have to click another link, so that they make more money in advertising, and you have to search to the bottom to find something important. So given the way journalism used to be, that's very similar to flash writing. You know, you want to start in the moment with what's important, ground someone where they are. And so only having 500 words to work with in this format for this class focused me on choosing just the right words and not putting in things that were unnecessary. And even though they may not have planned that on purpose, that was really a great way for me to learn. And so that's really sort of how I ended up in flash fiction.
So there was something about the economy of writing in a shorter form that you found challenging, and you enjoyed the challenge of, I keep going back to painting. It's like painting miniatures, you know? I mean, I really haven't thought about flash fiction in that way, but it really has that kind of aspect to it. Which actually leads me to one of your flash pieces, Thimble People, which I really enjoyed because, you know, it has a kind of like a miniature painting in it, in a way. And this is, would you consider this a speculative piece? I would sort of classify it that way.
Yes. In many ways, it's very different from a lot of my other writing. It's the first and only piece that I have sent out and that has been published, where I'm writing as a male character. And that was published at Wigleaf, and they've been great and supportive. And Thimble People is, I think we can say, about a man who finds a tiny thimble in the woods. And when he looks at it closely, he realizes there's a whole village of people living in this symbol. So yes, I would say that's another way I typically write realism, and that's not.
Well, you know, it's not. And yet when we get to the end of the story, we understand that there is, there's a logical explanation for what this man is experiencing. We're not going to spoil it here. But, you know, I think it's fair to say that at first it seems like magical realism, and this thimble holds this tiny village. And yet, you know, there's more than one explanation for this village appearing in this thimble for this gentleman.
I'm glad you're mentioning this, because I've just finished reading for Smoke Long Quarterly for the last for the summer issue, and I love reading submissions. Mm. I love reading submissions because it's a reminder to me of everything that I try to do in my stories. And it's easier to see in other people's stories sometimes than it is our own. And you always want a story that is more than just the events. You want it to build to something, point to something deeper, broader. And that story, even though it's about a thimble with a village inside, is really nothing about the village inside. And it's a whole lot to do with this man's relationship with his spouse. And that is very real for all of us who are involved with someone. So that's what interests me in writing, is that you can write about one thing and really point to another.
Yeah. And that is a perfect example of it. It's what I sometimes refer to as the bait and switch in writing, where, you know, you're hooked by, you're baited with this amazing tidbit of a story that turns out to be kind of peripheral to what's really going on at the heart of the story, although it's a thing that grabs your attention and gets you, you know, completely absorbed in the story. And yet, as in this story, there's a much larger issue that's going on here. And this is just kind of a symptom of what's happening in this man's world. So yeah, that is a really wonderful example of what can be accomplished in a flash fiction piece. Let's talk about Empty House, which is the story that brought you to my attention. And as you said, it was published in Kenyon Review. And it's a story about an unusual family, which features a very precocious young lady. She's a girl named Fern. How old is Fern in the story?
She's four, but almost five.
And yet you would never imagine that this could possibly be a child of that age because of the wisdom of this child. There's a lot of dialogue in the story between the mother and the child. And it's a story where the scenario is kind of flipped on its head, where the child is almost more of the parent in this situation than the mother. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, where the idea for this relationship came from when you were writing the story?
Yes, the original idea for the story came from a photograph I saw on Facebook in a group of photographers. And it was the picture of a young girl in a lawn chair, and her face was painted as a kitten or a cat, and she was wearing cat ears. And I often write to photographs. So I loved that picture, and I just started writing. So the beginning of that story is really the description of that photograph of her sitting out in the backyard eating cereal. and that's when the main character, her mother, comes out and has a conversation.
And Fern, how would you describe Fern?
As a parent, I think you did a good job of that. And she is a little feisty and very opinionated. And, you know, once I had that beginning, I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. So that first opening sat there for a while I was trying to figure out the story. The mother comes out in her bathrobe at noon to find out what's going on. And she smokes, the mother. And there's some animosity with the neighbor lady, who turns out to be Fern's grandmother. So we have three women here with not a real close relationship with any of them, I would say, and obvious history. And I just had a lot of trouble because I didn't understand this bathrobe wearing smoking woman who had no parenting skills whatsoever. I just didn't get it. So I showed what I had to a friend, a photographer. I think it's great to talk to people who are artists about our work who aren't necessarily writers, because they can see things in a different way. The creative process is so similar across different art genres. Mm-hmm. And it's just really helpful to have that extra insight. So I think we were on the phone for like a half an hour, 40 minutes, and she's listening to me talk about how I don't know where this is going. I don't understand this character. And she's like, wait, now just a minute. You do understand. You normally write as somewhat of the main character, and you're not the main character here. You do know that you're Fern, right? And I don't think I said anything for like a good 30 seconds as I realized she was so right. And once I understood that I was Fern and I knew Fern's point of view, I was able to figure everything out. Wow. Being a grown-up at 4 or 5 years old, I knew, I understood that. And even though the events that take place in that story or in any of my stories are made up, the emotions are always real.
And this kind of triangle of women is so fascinating because, as you said, the mother is not, she's always referred to as the lady next door.
The neighbor lady,
right?
In fact, that was the title originally, the neighbor lady.
And that's such an interesting choice. Obviously, it sets kind of a distance between the mother and the daughter, simply in the way she's referred to in the story. And yet she's there, she comes and goes. And it takes a while for the reader to kind of figure out that the neighbor lady is the mother, which is another fun thing in the story, I think. I hope that's not a spoiler for people who haven't
read
it.
Nope. The grandmother has a squirrel infestation and moves in pretty early on.
It took that photographer to kind of point out that, you know, you were kind of writing from the point of view of Fern as from your own experience. So is it something that you can comfortably talk about? You know, how is it that you are able to identify with a 4 to 5 year old who is so, you know, mature for their age, an old soul, as people like to call them?
It's so interesting that you ask that, because I have been trying for years and years to write this story. And I just recently figured out how I'm going to do that. And for the first time, I am writing creative nonfiction. And I have a format and chapter outlines for a novella in Flash. So this would be a novella or a short novel told instead of chapters, but in little Flash stories. And I have written many of them. Two of them are soon to be published. The first one I sent out was accepted by Jellyfish Review and will be online on November 4th.
Oh,
so I'm
wonderful.
Very excited about that.
Congratulations.
So
it's
through
great.
These separate pieces, I will tell the whole story, but we don't have time right now because it's a long story. People will start seeing these pieces come out. It is me and my mother, because it's nonfiction. I will tell the story of not only what happened to make me an adult at 5, but how that then affected my life and the choices I made later. Some of them not so smart, but we all have that, right? Mm. So I am going to tell that story now that I have found the right vehicle to do that. Images of separate moments in time that do add up and tell that story.
And you're doing it as creative nonfiction. You are comfortable with telling this story as you remember it happening in your life. I think people respond very strongly. I mean, of course, you know, they respond strongly to all prose, you know, for all kinds of reasons. But I think when people know that it's something that actually happened to the person who's writing about it, the connection is very different. In working on that, do you think about that at all?
I don't think about that per se, because in that story, Empty House, there is a very real element of that emotional feeling that's in that story. I understand Fern. She's not the point of view character. you know, the mother is, but I understand Fern very well. So there's always nonfiction nestled inside of fiction. So to me, if you read all of my fiction, you would see a lot about me. That makes me a little uncomfortable, sure, but people don't usually read everything all at once. So that makes me feel a little better. And I do find that my stories tend to gravitate around certain themes, even if I say I'm not going to write about that. I started a novel about a year ago and I said, I'm not going to write those themes because I've done a lot of that. I'm not doing that. And I started off and sure enough, that's the underlying theme of what is here. So I guess I'm not done.
So in some ways, the work starts to dictate how it's going to take shape. You start out with an intention, but the work can kind of intervene and take over. Do you feel that? Because that is something that I talk to writers about, and it happens more for some writers than others, I think.
There are two things I'm not in charge of. One is my hair. It does what it wants. I have no control. The other are my stories. I can start in a certain direction, but they'll be like, no, we're not going there. We're going over here. And I need to listen. I try to let whatever is inside of me that I'm not editing, not controlling, which is hard for me to let go. But to kind of be in that zone, to just write things down. It's almost like I'm not creating the story. I'm just writing down the story is the way it feels in that first draft. Once we get to revision, then that's a whole other matter. But in the beginning, I try to just step aside and let the story tell itself.
And do you find that when you go back to start editing, that you've kind of surprised yourself? Not being a writer myself, it kind of feels sometimes the way people describe it as like an out-of-body experience almost.
It is like that. I have a story coming out in the spring at New Ohio Review. It just won the fiction contest there. It's called Wolf. And I remember writing a line in that story. It's a young woman who has a husband, and the husband spends a lot of time in the garage rebuilding a 1968 Camaro. And she describes it as just an old car. And I had to stop typing and sit back and say to this character, who are you that you don't understand a classic car when you see it or hear about it, that you're just calling it just an old car? How could you do that? And yet I typed it. It came out of it. I am such a car person. I come from a car family. So that was a little disturbing to me. But yeah, there are definitely things that people say and do that surprise me.
And you actually had to stop and kind of lecture that character.
I was horrified. I'm like, this is a classic car.
Oh my goodness. That is a great story, Julia. I love that. Wow. So there really is, I mean, it is kind of like a split personalities situation. Sometimes it seems like for writers, it's true of all artists that the best art comes when you know that you have entered the zone and you're not even aware of what's taking place. It's just kind of flowing through you.
The reality is, you're right. You're absolutely right. But the reality is, this particular character was not someone who would appreciate that car. And my subconscious knew that and did what it was supposed to do. I was just stunned when the line came out.
Did you have trouble getting back into the story after that happened?
That was such a long time ago. That was one of the first stories that I started. So it took me a very long time, about 10 years almost, to get that story where I wanted it. So
10 years.
That was a very important story for me. And I'm very thrilled about the results, and I'm excited for it to come out next year. Again, I think every story is important because it's emotionally connected, even though the events didn't happen to me. Right back to the emotion.
So you didn't actually submit it anywhere until you were, after 10 years, you decided it was ready to be submitted for publication?
No, I did submit it earlier, and I workshopped it. And then I went back and rewrote it. And I mean, I kept working on it. It didn't have sentence problems. It had structure problems, which is often the last thing a new writer, you know, can get their hands around. It needed to tell the story in the right way.
That's an interesting way to put it.
I mean, there's the story and then there's the telling of the story.
Right.
And those two entirely different things.
So you find that that's more in the editing stages where you're looking at it from that point of view, obviously.
Yes, that often comes later for me, although sometimes it comes first. So the story of what happened to me and my mother, in this case, I needed the structure first because I've tried to write this as a story. I've tried to write this in many ways, many different times throughout my life, and it's never been right. And now that I'm writing it as a novella in Flash, it all makes sense and it needs that structure.
How did you arrive at that structure? How did that occur to you as the thing that would make it work best for you?
I have a document with lots of mom-related things. And like I said, I've been thinking about it for such a long time that when Jellyfish Review early, just like a few months ago, announced they were going to be reading Little Sayings, that was their theme, and they wanted at least one line of dialogue. And I wrote a piece for them that was, it was just reading their call for submissions. And I said, I'm just writing, I know what I'm writing and I'm writing this thing. And it's mostly dialogue and it made sense. And I sent it off and they were very excited about it, which is always exciting. But it just made me see that this is the way to do it. And novellas and Flash have become popular. I've read more and more of them. And Michael Loveday has a great book called Novella in Flash that is a craft book on that. And that it's excellent. So I think that's the right form. I could change my mind 6 months from now because I know how that works, but I don't think so. And I probably have 6 or 7 pieces already written. I have not submitted them all. I'm going to submit some, not all of them. And I also needed a break from the novel. I just finished the first draft of the novel and I'm letting it sort of sit and I'm putting together an outline. And while I do that, I thought I'll write some Flash fiction. And that is the project I'm working on in my spare time.
I was just thinking, you know, when you were talking about this relationship, these Flash pieces being, you know, moments of your relationship with your mother. Is your mother still alive?
Yes.
Do you talk with her about writing this?
No. She, at this point, would not understand or remember what I would be talking about.
Okay. I'm always curious when people write personal history stuff, you know, about the members of their families, if they're writing about family members, you know, how they may feel about them taking, you know, moments, memories from their lives. So this, for you, is not something that you need to be concerned about it, obviously.
It's not, but I've certainly thought about it for a long time. And I think that the reason I can now write about it is because I understand her better. It's not enough for me just to tell my story. There's a reason she did the things that she did. And I think it's important for a reader to understand that. This is not a hit piece on my mother. This is, people are complicated and interesting and everybody has something that they deal with. And this just is mine. And I'm sure there are other people, other women out there dealing with this same issue that it might be helpful.
Yeah. Mother-daughter relationships have their own unique dynamics, I think. I say that having observed my sister and my mother through my childhood years and teenage years and how they interacted. So I know how complicated and, you know, challenging that relationship can be. And it does find its way into a lot of women writers' stories, I've found. The mother relationship and mothers in general show up in your stories. Bright and Bleached, let's talk about that, because that has a lot of aspects that kind of dovetail with Empty House for me in a way, just in terms of the relationships. We'll just start out by saying there's a 15-year-old girl who has decided to move in with her uncle, her mother's brother, who lives right next door to them.
Right.
Her older sisters have gone off on into their own lives, and she has made this choice at 15 to not live with her mother anymore, you know, which kind of harkens back to the neighbor lady, you know, who lives next door, who kind of lives with the daughter and granddaughter, you know. So there's this kind of odd permutation of these households. In this story, the mother is kind of a mysterious character. She's, you know, she's spoken about, she's kind of the focus of the story, but we never actually see the mother in this story. You want to talk a little bit about this story? And
you're doing such a good job. Like everything you say is absolutely right.
Well, because, you know, I'm remembering it and enjoying it, the memory of it as I'm, you know, just trying to describe it. But tell us a little bit about how you came up with this idea. And that's always a tough question. I do this to people.
I remember.
I put them on the spot, but I'm sorry if I...
No. I remember this interesting. Someone yesterday on Twitter asked, what was your first publication? And it's such an interesting thing because I sent the very first thing I sent out was a group of three stories. Let's Say, which was flash fiction that went to Smoke Long Quarterly. They picked it up and it got put into the Best Small Fictions anthology. And they did that within a week, but that went out at the same time that Bright and Bleached went out and another story, A Marriage. And Bright and Bleached got picked up by the end of the year. It won the Glimmer Train Fiction Award for New Writers. Mm. And South Dakota Review picked up A Marriage in February. So I sent out three stories to three places and they got picked up. And I thought, well, this is going to be easy. But nothing since then has been that easy. But that story, Bright and Bleached, is very much the anger that I had toward my mother. And that was a story I had tried to tell a lot, the story of some of her issues. And I remember starting that story being angry. And had I known we were going to talk about this, I would have looked it up just to be sure. But I believe that the beginning line, and I did start this story at Kenyon Review Writers Workshop, and I got to read it out loud. And it was amazing to see the audience reaction to the opening. And that's all I had. I didn't have the whole story. But, you know, that story starts out with, I tell people my mother is a drug addict, even though she's not. And that was the line or the two sentences that allowed me to start telling what the real problem is. And it was that anger of, oh, telling someone that someone is a drug addict is a better answer than telling them what one of my mother's issues was. So again, the emotions of that story are true. And a lot of people love the uncle, Uncle Leroy. I still get emails or tweets about how much people love Uncle Leroy. But in my real life there, I don't have an Uncle Leroy. And those events didn't happen to me. And I don't have sisters. And, you know, people always ask these questions. So the events didn't happen, but the emotions are real.
And that 15-year-old at the center of the story finds very interesting ways to cope with the emotions that she's feeling. And what I really was fascinated by is that you take that my mother is a drug addict lie that she creates at this beginning of the story, and it kind of gets embellished as the story goes on. And this girl has done like research to learn about all of the terminology.
Well, if you're going to lie about something, you have to be credible. So you've got to look it up.
Yeah. So clearly this child is of high intelligence and she's understanding the world in a way that is not typical. Again, you know, this is a child who is interacting with the world on a level not typical of someone their age. And, you know, there's a sophistication in their way of thinking, like Fern in Empty House. So if these are reflections of you, I mean, I cannot wait to read that flash fiction novella, the creative nonfiction work that you're doing, because this is like the perfect introduction to knowing more about where these characters came from. It's going to be a really wonderful transition for readers to go from reading some of these stories to reading that work when it's completed. Do you ever think about
it? It's interesting because, again, I just realized this episode is going to be available on October 5th. And a month later, November 4th, is when Jellyfish Review is running that very first flash that is part of that project. It's called Hello, And so, you know, look.
Perfect. That's good to know. I'm glad that's coming up in the interview here. I want to talk about Nougatine. Nougatine is a story that was I was so touched by. It's a sad story, and yet, you know, you always have humor in your stories, even when they're on the sad end of the spectrum sometimes. Like, you always find a way to insert humor. It may not be like laugh out loud humor, but there's a way that you are able to bring humor to even some of the harder situations that you describe in some of these stories. So
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because as a writer, I think that I owe a reader something. And I know there are writers that say we don't owe the reader anything, but I like to either give humor or lyric sentences, the beauty of the sentence or humor. I think you, and that particular story has both.
Yeah, and the humor, you know, tends to be kind of offhanded humor as opposed to Empty House, which is really full of very funny stuff. You know, it's the humor is kind of front and center in that story. But it's part of what makes characters human is, you know, even in their darkest moments, being able to see that they can find humor in something. You know, that's something that we can all relate to. But the character in Nougatine is another troubled young person. I shouldn't say another because,
No,
well,
they all are. You're right.
but her situation is much more serious in that she's, and it's not a spoiler to say because the story starts out with the fact that at the age of 16, she's had to put her child up for adoption.
Yes.
And then she becomes obsessed with the idea of finding this child and kind of spying on the family, you know, and the child. And it takes very interesting turns, you know. It sets up something, and then there's kind of a twist at the end that's unexpected. And again, you do this in your stories where you set something up and you kind of lead people in, you pull them in, and then at the end, there's like a little twist to the story that kind of turns everything around to be seen in a very different light. And this is one of those stories. I just am curious about the notion of, you know, putting a child up for adoption. Did that come out of, you know, a particular place, or?
You're gonna find this amusing. So I like to write often first drafts when I'm sort of half asleep, because then my editing brain is asleep and it's not paying attention and I'm like tricking it. So this was late at night, and I'm one of those weird people that has an Instagram account for my cat because I wanted to learn how Instagram worked, and it was easier to give her an account and figure out the algorithm and so forth. So she has a lot of friends worldwide, and she has a lot more followers than I do. And it's an issue in the household.
I'm not surprised to hear that, Julia, I have to
But
say.
one of her friends lives in Paris, and her friend's name is a black cat called Nougatine. And my cat is a black cat as well. And so I found myself writing the first sentence, "I want to name a cat Nougatine," because I've seen pictures of this other cat for so long. And then I thought, well, I thought my editing brain was asleep, but it wasn't. And it said, no. And I rewrote the sentence, "I want to name a girl baby Nougatine." And that is how it started over an Instagram cat account. So once I realized, again, the beginning scene, and she tries out the name on a stranger, then I started researching weird jobs that a person could have. And then I came up with a list and chose a few for her. You've already talked about a couple of interesting things with respect to all of my stories. They often have to do with creating a family. The characters gather people or ducks or dogs or whatever around them to create their own family. And that is very much what I have done all my life. Again, it'll all be clear when the novella is done. So that is certainly happening throughout this story in a different way from the other stories. But I find fiction writing to be very freeing because it allows me to take on a persona that isn't who I am in real life. Like many other writers, I have a day job. In my case, my day job has nothing to do with writing. I work in the finance industry, and that's a very controlled, responsible, gotta love spreadsheets kind of world to live in. And I, in real life, am the person you're going to call if you need bail money or if you're in trouble. I go fix things. And there's a lot of stress, pressure that goes with being the person that has to fix everything. But I have a long history of that starting at five. So I. I'm well qualified, but when I write fiction, it allows me to be like, oh, but what if I wasn't that person? What if I was the irresponsible person? Or what if I made the wrong choice? Or what if I did something in this story that I would never do in real life? And how fun is that? And that is why all of my characters are like so quirky.
Well, your imagination, I mean, you have so many things to bring to these stories, obviously from, you know, your life experience, but then you have an imagination that lifts these into an entire different realm. And that is the joy in reading these stories. It's always interesting to hear about the personal connections that people have to characters or situations in their stories, but it's the imagination that sets great writers apart from so-so writers, you know, and that's where, you know, I find you've created these people and these situations that are unforgettable. And Nougatine is, like I said, it's a sad story, but yet it's not. It's a hopeful story. Is that a conscious choice that you make sometimes with stories?
I'm an optimist. And so that does, I think, come through at the end of all of my stories. They may not always work out, but there's always hope for something else or a different way. Or, you know, we don't always get what we want in life, and we've got to keep going and figure out how to get by and how to gather toward us the things that we don't have. So I'm not sure it's a conscious thing, but it certainly lives deep inside of me and it comes out.
Well, it's all part of a large scheme in your writing that is so exciting to watch develop. And I'm so looking forward to the works that you're in process with. Now, the novel, before we end, I just wanted to ask you a couple things about the novel. At what stage would you say you're at with that?
I thought I was near the end, but I was only near the end of the first draft. And I'm now making an outline of what's there and revising the outline so that I can start the second draft. I do tend to clean as I go, so my sentences are in good shape, but the structure is not. And, you know, I've been in this place before where I need to go back and fix that, make sure that all the storylines are building the way they need to. Now that I know the ending of the book, I can go back and rewrite with that knowledge. And that is so important. So probably realistically, since I have the job and I teach, probably another year.
Now, did you decide to write the novel because it's kind of expected that authors, when they're trying to get their work published, you know, that they would have a novel in the pipeline? That's always like the first question that a lot of people in the publishing industry ask, I would imagine. Do you have a novel? do you get that?
I have gotten that in the past, but I've always been very clear. I am not writing a novel. I am not writing anything that long. Not happening. No. And what happened was, I teach at NYU, I teach at night, and it's a long drive home. I was on the FDR going home, dark out, and all of a sudden, out loud, I said, I'm going to write a novel. And it's kind of like that sentence from the Wolf story where she was talking about that car being just an old car. And I thought, where did this come from? Because it wasn't like I was thinking about anything. And I don't drive around talking out loud to myself when I'm alone in the car. That doesn't happen. But yet this happened. I didn't know what I was going to write, but it happened.
So that was a very powerful inner voice that decided to come out on that drive home from teaching.
I told
that
you,
day.
I'm not in control. I'm not in control of my hair or the stories and apparently what I write.
But that didn't frighten you, obviously. That
it did.
Oh, it did? Okay.
Oh, it did. I'm like, no. The novel is so long and it's so, I mean, compared to flash fiction and short stories, and it's so hard to hold all of that information in your head at the same time. It's like a child holding too many cards in their hand. That's really hard to do. And that's been frustrating for me.
The fun, I would imagine, is in the challenge, is figuring out how to make it work. So hopefully you will have fun in continuing your work on that novel.
And I'm excited to finish it.
Yeah, that's going to feel good, I'm sure. So good luck with that, Julia.
Thank you.
We will look for all of these things in the future. And I'm so happy that you took time out of your day today to spend this with us. This has been just a joy. Stay well, and thank you again, Julia.
Thanks, John. This has been a lot of fun, and I really like listening to your other podcasts, so I'm very excited.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, this is going to be a great episode. I'm very excited to hear what the reaction is going to be, so we'll all look forward to that. Take care.
Thank you.
You can find links to Julia's stories, essays, and interviews on her website, juliastreyer.com. And now we're going to move on to the short story. I'll be reading Empty House, which was first published in the Kenyon Review online. So here it is, Empty House by Julia Strayer. I stumbled out the back slider in my bathrobe and bare feet to find Fern, her face painted into a cat, hair teased into small ears. She sat in the backyard cross-legged in her kitty lawn chair, wearing striped pajamas and eating cereal from a bowl. "The neighbor lady paint your face?" she nodded, crunching her cereal. "And make your breakfast?"
"Me."
She answered the flamingo I had stuck in the ground so we'd have more than weeds to look at. "How long before you can make your own lunch?" "Why aren't you like other moms?" "Good question." I looked down at the toes that needed polish. "You throw my cigarettes away again?" "Grandma says you should use that money for my college." I tried quitting 300 times, but never knew what to do with my hands. I held them up, older looking than they should be. "You seem to have this under control, so I'm going back to bed."
"No,"
she cried out, spoon clanking against the bowl.
"You have to drive me to Shelley's Halloween birthday party. I'm a cat."
"It's June."
"There are no rules for Halloween."
"I see that." The sun was almost directly overhead, and the outside world was brighter than it needed to be. It should have a dimmer switch. "Can't the neighbor lady take you?"
"Grandma said to tell you her tires are flat."
"Are they?" She shook her head. "Fine, go get dressed." I dropped Fern off, waved at Shelley's mother from the car so she wouldn't see my bathrobe, swung by Mike's mighty bright laundromat and slotted quarters in the cigarette machine. I liked the feel of the coins and the sound they made when they landed in the coin box. Probably the only machine left of its kind, but nothing ever changed at Mike's. It looked exactly as it had when I was a child, and everyone at the laundromat was used to seeing me in my bathrobe. I liked to sit in the parking lot and smoke because it gave me time to think, and no one there nagged me to stop smoking. After I finished my cigarette, I drove home, with a gas gauge on E, to find the neighbor lady drinking coffee in my kitchen. "You could at least clean if you're going to drink my coffee."
"You reek of smoke."
She waved her hand around in my direction. Her hands looked younger than mine.
"This is how you present yourself around town?"
"A new low for you." "Not really," I said. "I wore this last week at the bank and to drop off recycling."
"We should talk about what you're doing with your life."
"I'm going back to bed."
"I moved myself into your room because I have a squirrel infestation and moved you into Fern's room. I thought you'd prefer that to the couch."
"Why didn't you move yourself into her room?"
"My girl should be with her mother."
"Oh, that's good coming from you."
"We can all learn from our mistakes. She might even let you have the top bunk."
"She'll never let me smoke in there." I headed down the hall toward Fern's room. "You have to pick her up at Shelley's house at 4 o'clock. I have no gas in the car."
"She's your daughter."
"You owe me."
"Is there ever going to be an expiration date on that?"
I shut the bedroom door. Fern arrived home with new Peppa Pig toys to add to her collection. She brought them all out to the kitchen table, stuffed Peppa and family into a plastic car as if the Pig family had some place to go. "They do," she said. "They go to the market and the movies and for pizza. They're a real family." "We're real," I said, opening a microwave lasagna box. "Not like Shelley. She has a father."
"You have a father."
"Where is he?"
"Somewhere not here."
"What did you do to make him leave?"
"Did the neighbor lady put you up to this?"
I woke in the middle of the night, craving something I couldn't define. I figured I'd sit on the front step and smoke a cigarette. Light glowed from the kitchen.
Fern was clinging to the inside of the open refrigerator door, its cold spreading out. She wore a short white tutu over Peppa Pig pajamas. "I'm pretending to be a tuna sandwich."
"Let me know when you're done. I'm going outside to smoke."
"I'm done."
She jumped down and closed the refrigerator, leaving us both in the dark.
The microwave blinked 2:05. Why are you awake? Why are you awake? You know you're only 4, right?
Almost 5.
I opened the front door and Fern followed me outside. I thought you were going to bed.
I'll keep you company if you promise not to smoke.
How about you go to bed and I promise not to smoke? She tipped her head and said, okay, then thrust out her open hand. What's that for?
Grandma calls them cancer sticks.
I stared down at the shortest boss I ever had. Fine, but I want them back in the morning. She walked down the hall toward her room.
Who's the mother here?
We'll see, she said, shutting the door. I sat on the step, leaned against the porch pillar, rested my hands on my lap, then one knee, then pulled my hair back, then back to my lap. I made a mental note to watch what non-smokers did with their hands. The night was a nice cool one. A dog barked a few houses down, and the moon looked over the street. Houses all shut and dark and asleep. Trash cans waited at the curb for morning pickup. From the outside, our house looked like the others, small cottages that looked more tired than cute. It was the kind of night I used to drive Fern around to get her to sleep when she was a baby. I was afraid she'd wake if I turned off the engine, so I often kept driving until I found myself in her father's neighborhood, locked tight inside his house with wife and kids. I imagined what it would be like to stop the car, ring the doorbell, and introduce him to his daughter, but I never did. When we were still together, I used to tell him I felt like an empty house when I wasn't with him. The next day, Fern and I stopped at the hardware store to find a solution to the neighbor lady's squirrels. I spoke with the clerk, a boy surely not old enough to drive, and he said I could rent a Havahart trap. After running through all the choices, one-door models versus two, type of bait to use, best places to set the trap, how often to check it, and what to do once I caught one, Fern slapped a paint color strip on the counter, pointed to Tickled Pink, and said to the boy, "This one, please." He looked at me. "How much paint will you need?" I raised my eyebrows and gestured in that I have no idea what she's thinking way, and Fern said,
"A gallon of flat will do."
The boy asked, "What are you painting?"
"My dressing room."
I said, "You don't have a dressing room."
"I will once we paint it."
We walked the street of shops, and Fern stopped at each plate glass window to make faces at her reflection. She wanted to go inside the drugstore to test lipsticks, as we often did, layering pinks over nudes until she found a shade she liked. I always told her she looked nice without the lipstick, and she always said, "I know." "Not today. We need to get home." We passed the pet store that had just set up with shelter dogs for adoption out front. Fern ran up to the largest, goofiest dog, a yellow lab.
"This one, please."
"We don't need a dog."
"Grandma and I need a dog. The kind who gives kisses."
"Then she can get a kissing dog for her house once the squirrels move out."
"Real families have dogs."
"Where do you get these ideas? Like I have time to feed a dog."
"We both know I'll feed him."
He was about 7 years old. His owner, an elderly man, had recently died, and although I worried the dog's eventual death would be traumatic for Fern, he was eligible for the senior discount program, meaning his adoption fee was waived and the rescue organization covered all his wellness visits. I dropped them both off at the house along with food bowls, dog bed the size of a small couch, and chew toys. I told the neighbor lady this was all her fault, then drove to Mike's Mighty Bright for cigarettes. Fern's father smoked. When Fern learned to walk, I learned to smoke. It was a way to keep him with me. I smoked one in the car, staring at the laundromat's outside wall with its large painted letters, "Laundry today or naked tomorrow,"
and a picture of clothes hanging on a line, which made no sense.
A laundromat should have pictures of dryers or folded towels, shirts on hangers, and matched socks. I imagined cigarettes, clothes pinned to the line. I stubbed out my cigarette and wondered if Fern's father quit smoking when he quit me. I set up the squirrel trap in the neighbor lady's attic, using peanut butter as bait. I didn't see signs of animals. No noises, no chewed wires, no scampering, no droppings, no strange smells, no visible holes, no water damage from urine, no tracks on the floor. I wasn't a rodent expert, but I was an expert on my mother, and I was fairly certain she didn't have squirrels. I sat on an old rocking chair and smoked another cigarette. When I was growing up, my mother used to tell me if I didn't behave, she'd lock me in the attic where my dead sister, Mary, lived.
I never had a sister, but I still believed it possible. Whenever we heard a noise from upstairs, she'd say, "There goes your dead sister, Mary, wandering around the attic, probably looking for you." At 8 years old, I finally climbed the attic stairs to confront the ghost and discovered nothing but dust. I smoked my cigarette down to the nub and left the rest of the pack and the lighter on the chair before leaving. That night, I tucked Fern into the bottom bunk so Pickle could sleep on his dog bed next to her.
"You smell like cigarettes."
"You smell like toothpaste."
"You promised."
"No, I didn't."
"You should."
"I should do a lot of things." I later found Fern and Pickle spooning on her bed with no place for me to fit my foot to climb up to the top bunk, so I slept on the couch. The next morning, I woke to Pickle licking my lips and Fern crunching cereal watching Peppa cartoons. I smelled coffee, so I made my way to the kitchen to find the neighbor lady reading my newspaper at the table with two mugs in front of her. "Is one of those mine?" She said, "I drank your cup a half hour ago." "Maybe you'd like to make another pot while I go next door to collect a squirrel from the trap, unless you want to come with me. I'll make coffee."
"You do that."
"There's no rush. Squirrels move about in the day, so they probably haven't seen the peanut butter yet. You want me to say hi to Mary while I'm there?"
"Why are you you?"
"I could ask you the same question." The attic was as I had left it, quiet, clean. The trap was empty, peanut butter still on the plate. I could play along for a while. The attic was peaceful.
No kids, dog, mother.
No expectations. I lit a cigarette and wondered if my mother would have been a better mother if my father hadn't died so early, but there was no answer to that. Smoke curled in the light through the dormers, and I imagined it curling the same way in my lungs. I held it in, waiting for the release, that feeling of calm it brought. I used to feel that way with Fern's father. He made it so I could breathe. No thinking or worrying. No one wanting or expecting. Just the moment. By the time I got back to my house, Fern had Pickle decked out in hat and dress. He didn't care. Followed Fern around the house, out of the house, back into the house. They were about the same height. She put her face close up to his face, and I imagined him eating her whole head. She opened her mouth and stuck her tongue out, and Pickle opened his mouth and stuck his tongue out, and she laughed and laughed, and he curled his upper lip and burped, which sent her into hysterics. The neighbor lady handed me a cup of coffee, said, "You smell like cigarettes." "So I've been told."
"I thought you were quitting."
"Do you and Fern work out your routines together?"
"Do you know what you're talking about?"
"No sign of squirrels."
"Go figure."
She busied herself sponging the kitchen counter.
"Should I make you some eggs?"
"You don't know how to cook."
"I get by."
I packed sandwiches, and Fern and Pickle and I headed to the town pond for a picnic. I thought it might be something real families did. There were other families and ducklings and puffy clouds. Picnic perfection. Pickle and Fern ran around and splashed about in the water while I set out the blanket and shook lemonade powder into a water jug. I imagined what I'd say if we ran into Fern's father someplace like this. It would depend on whether he was alone or with his family. Sometimes I thought it would be good for him to know about Fern, good for him and her, but then it could be bad for his wife and family and bad for me. What if he pretended he didn't know me? Or worse, what if he wanted custody? Even worse, what if he didn't want anything to do with Fern? I needed a cigarette, but I didn't have one with me. Fern and Pickle ran up from the pond and dripped on the blanket, waiting for their sandwiches. I gave peanut butter and jelly to Fern and a sandwich of microwave meatloaf to Pickle. They both seemed pleased. Three ducklings had followed them up the bank, stood on the blanket, so I offered them some watermelon. From a distance, I was certain we looked like a real family, except for the ducklings. Fern and Pickle and the ducklings played in the water for a while, and then we packed up for home. The ducklings followed Pickle to the car. I looked around for a mother duck, but didn't see one. He picked up each duckling in his mouth and set them one by one on the back seat. Then he jumped up and stretched out on the seat. Ducklings snuggled up close, and he licked them dry. Fern said, "Pickle is their mother now."
"Just what we need."
We stopped at the hardware store on the way home to get duck supplies. Pickle followed Fern. Ducklings followed Pickle. The boy clerk greeted us with a nod.
"How's the squirrel trapping going?"
"Looks like I'll need the trap for another day."
"Should have caught one by now. You sure you have squirrels?"
"I'm certain we don't." He misunderstood my answer and suggested flowering cardboard and setting it on the attic floor so we could identify the animal's tracks.
If it's some other animal, you may need different bait.
I'll give that some thought. Fern pointed to a stack of small plastic kiddie pools, blue with colored fish circling inside.
This one, please.
I looked at the boy clerk and nodded. Fern said,
And duck food. You people have a lot going on at your house. I wish I lived with you growing up.
Back at home, I found the neighbor lady rolling tickled pink on Fern's walls, but it looked like she got more on herself than the walls. Fern clapped her hands together and danced around, admiring the room, and asked if she could paint her hair pink, too. I dragged the kiddie pool to the backyard next to the flamingo and unspooled the hose. While the water started filling, I went to the kitchen to unpack the picnic, dice cucumber, and check the freezer for dinner ideas. Fern, come take this cucumber for your ducks. She arrived wearing pink shorts,
pink shirt,
pink tutu. And turn off the hose when the pool is full. As Fern left, the neighbor lady carried in the paint can and brush. There's a little paint left in case you need to make something pink. Her hair was frosted tickled pink. She dropped the brush in the kitchen sink, washed it out with dishwashing liquid. I watched her and remembered how I used to bathe Fern in that sink the way my mother said she used to bathe me in the kitchen sink next door.
Goes around, comes around.
I opened the freezer and reviewed our selections as the neighbor lady hammered the lid back on the paint can.
I've been thinking you should go on one of those dating sites.
I pulled my head out of the freezer.
Pizza bacon bites?
No, I said you should sign up for a dating site. We could make up something to make you look like you have a life.
You've been breathing paint fumes.
You'll have to quit smoking. No man wants a wife who smells like an ashtray.
I grabbed a box of frozen mac and cheese, closed the freezer.
I don't want a man. That's how I got into all this. No, you made a bad choice.
She waved the hammer around for emphasis. I think she forgot she still had it in her hand.
Why are you never on my side?
Why do you always see sides? You flunked mother's school, didn't you?
You're right there with me.
Fern is fine. We both looked at each other, unblinking, a moment in which neither of us knew what to say. I struggled to open the mac and cheese, and she motioned to put it on the counter. Once I did, she hammered the corner until it burst open. Fern yelled in from the
backyard, Pickle! Pool is
ready! Pickle walked through the kitchen and out to the pool, a rubber duck from the bathroom in his mouth, his toenails clicking on the floor. The ducklings followed close behind. The neighbor lady and I watched the parade until they were all outside. The neighbor lady carried the paint can and hammer toward the garage.
You really should clip his nails.
I stuck the mac and cheese on the sheet pan and shoved it into the oven with as much clatter as I could make. I'm going to check on the squirrels.
There's no need to keep running over there, she said,
but I was already out the door. The trap was untouched, of course. I smoked a cigarette, watching out the attic dormer at the chaos in my backyard. I wondered if my life would have looked the same if Fern's father had chosen to stay with us. Ducklings diving for cucumber in the pool water, Pickle standing in the pool lapping up water from the hose Fern was holding. She had found a pair of my old sunglasses and wore them with her pink tutu outfit. I opened the window to hear the splashing, but by then Aretha Franklin's Respect played from somewhere in my house, and Fern sang along, using the hose as a microphone, working it like a diva, and I didn't know where she even learned of Aretha, and I felt lost, like I missed something in her life, or maybe mine. I envied her sense of being, of knowing she had a right to be who she wanted to be. Fern's room smelled of paint, so we camped in the living room. Pickle stretched out on the couch, and Fern curled up in the empty space in front of him, unwilling to move him. She scrunched herself under his paws, and it looked as if he was hugging her. The ducklings slept near Pickle on the top of the couch, all in a row. I slept on the recliner. I woke in the dark of early morning, listened for Fern's tiny breaths between Pickle's snoring. When she was younger, I would sit in her room when she napped to make sure she kept breathing. I couldn't get back to sleep, so I snuck outside. I had taken a cigarette from the attic earlier. I rolled it in my fingers, breathed in the tobacco scent, but didn't light it. Holding it was enough. It gave my hands something to do. Sat on my front steps to feel the summer breeze on my skin. The street was quiet, most houses dark.
real families sleeping inside on beds, not couches, and without ducklings. I hoped Fern would ask again to make her hair pink, because I would help her do it. I'd tell her to do it all right now, whatever you want, because someday you'll age out and people will start to expect things of you. Her hair would look lovely with tiny pink strands, but I wouldn't tell her so. I wouldn't want her to think how she looked mattered. I wanted to take the bathroom mirror off the wall and paint "You Look Fine." A police car, flashing its lights but not the siren, creeped up the street and stopped in front of my walk. The policeman let the neighbor lady out and walked her to my porch, stood at the bottom of the steps, and said, "Hello, ma'am. I understand you know this woman?"
"Depends on what she's done."
"Picked her up on misdemeanor vandalism."
"Meaning?"
"She painted 'Fuck Your Cigarettes' on the wall of Mike's Mighty Bright in pink."
"You keep her."
If it's all right with you, ma'am, I'd appreciate it if you'd take her. I understand she's your mother."
"Not for as long as I can remember."
She glared at me, her eyes shining like a stray cat in the flashing lights. "Why do you always go there?" Then she looked at the police officer and said, "Thank you for bringing me home."
The officer hurried to his car as if he thought I'd make him take her. He turned off the flashing lights and the street settled into dark again as he drove away. An old woman who climbs ladders in support hose and sensible shoes to paint obscenities on other people's buildings. No wonder I'm who I am.
I have nothing to explain.
I didn't even know you were gone. Aren't you a little old to be sneaking out like a teenager?
Didn't know I had to run everything by you.
All my life, you've done exactly what you've wanted without any thought to me. When do I get that chance?
This from the woman running around town in her bathrobe?
What do you think Fern will have to say about that in a few years?
And don't you smoke every chance you get.
Fern already has a lot to say about that now.
She sat next to me on the step.
What kind of mother would I be if I let you smoke?
Would you let Fern smoke?
I shook my head. We sat quiet for a bit, and I said, "Why did you lie about the squirrels?"
"How long have you known?"
"Pretty much from the beginning. Why didn't you just tell me?"
"You never would have let me move in. It's lonely to live alone. That's why I want you to find someone."
"Life isn't that simple."
"It should be."
"Go to bed. I'll go down to Mike's tomorrow and see what we can do to fix your artwork. I'll come inside in a few minutes."
When Fern's father left, he said he needed to focus on his family. He meant his real family, and he meant I wasn't part of that. I knew if I ever ran into him on the street or in the park, I would tell him he's part of my family because Fern is my family and she is part of him. I would tell him she waves to airplanes when they fly overhead. She dresses herself because she knows best how to do it. She says the Ace of Spades is significant, but has trouble saying the word significant. She collects animals without families, has no fear of being herself. When Fern's father left, he told me, "People you love become ghosts inside you." I didn't say anything at the time, but if I ever saw him again, I would tell him I'm a regular haunted house. The next morning, Pickle licked my lips to wake me, and I began to think that would be my fate every morning. I found Fern outside in her pajamas, sitting in the kiddie lawn chair, her hair braided with pink ribbons. She stirred chocolate syrup into her milk, dangled her feet in the pool. Ducklings floated. Pickle ran out and belly-flopped in the water, nearly tipping the pool, causing the ducklings to quack and flap their wings. Fern laughed, wearing a clown smile of chocolate milk.
Thank you, Julia, for allowing us to read that winsome and heartwarming story. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Min-Young Lee. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. Across the bridge of stories are